Welcome to Through the Bible with Les Feldman, a 30-minute walk through the Scriptures, teaching in-depth Bible truths that change people's lives. Now, here is your host, Les Feldman.
Okay, once again, we're all back from break, and we'll get right back in where we left off in our last program. And I merely want to invite our television audience to study the Scripture with us. Don't take my word for anything, and for goodness sakes, don't take anybody else's either. But search the Scriptures, see if these things are really so, and learn to compare Scripture with Scripture. You can't build doctrine on just a single verse, most generally. All right, I'm going to skip all the other comments, and we're going to get right back into where we left off in Genesis chapter 3. And again, we're just going to remind our audience that we're doing a study now on the eight covenants coming up through the Old Testament, and seven of them will be consummated before the second coming, and then the eighth one will be fulfilled when the kingdom is set up. But we're going to come back to the second Adamic covenant yet in this program for start. We may get on to the next one. But come back with me to Genesis chapter 3, and we'll continue on in verse 17. We were in verse 16 in the last program. And now in this one, we'll take verse 17, now unto Adam. Now this is all part of God setting up the format for the human existence for the next 6,000 years. This covenant has never yet been changed or brought back. It is still valid. And so to Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, that is, by eating of the tree, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake, in sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. And here comes again the result of the curse, thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. And thou shalt eat the herb of the field, in other words, those things which grow naturally. And in verse 19, and in the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread. In other words, he's going to have to work for everything that he needs for his daily existence. And till thou return to the ground, that's the picture of physical death. For out of it, that is, out of the dust of the ground, wast thou taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Now that pretty much sets the format then for human existence under the curse. Now remember that all of the world's problems, all the world's misery, famine, war, disease, and suffering, and heartache is not God's fault. It's all brought in by the curse. And old Satan, of course, is the fomenter of it all. Now, I think one of the best places I can take into the New Testament of all this would be Romans chapter 8. And this says it so graphically. Romans chapter 8. We're going to start at verse 18. Now, again, we've looked at these verses in previous programs, some words way in the past. But we'll look at them again. Romans chapter 8. Verse 18. Romans 8, drop in at verse 18, where the apostle writes, for I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy, in other words, they're nothing, to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed to us. Now, I got to stop there a second. How much does the Bible tell us about our future eternal heavenly experience? That's right. Almost nothing. You know, people have written, are we going to have homes? Are we going to have kitchens? Are we going to prepare food? Are we going to do this and that? Well, I just have to plead ignorance because the Bible doesn't tell us. We don't know what we're going to be doing. We don't know what our circumstances will be. What will be some of the glories that God is preparing for us? Well, I usually answer, your guess is as good as mine, because I cannot show you from Scripture what we're going to be doing, how we're going to be doing it, or what. All I can say is, and some of you have heard me say it 100 times, it's going to be glorious. It's going to be glorious, and that's as far as we can take it scripturally. But now the other side of the coin, what's it like under the curse? That we can tell you. Next verse. For the earnest, the very down deep heartfelt expectation of the creation, all of creation. And I think I'm not stretching the envelope again to say that it involves the universe. I may be wrong, and I don't mind somebody disagreeing, but I think creation means everything. And the whole creation is waiting patiently for the manifestation or the bringing into the spotlight of what group of people? The sons of God. That's you and I. We are the born ones up there in verse 17. See? And so all of creation is waiting for the day when you and I as believers are finally brought into that eternal environment with a new body, a resurrected body like Christ's body. And that is, of course, the triggering of the removal of the curse when we are finally brought to our eternal place. All right, so all of creation is waiting for that. Now the next one, verse 20, for the creation, the whole creation was made subject to vanity. Well, vanity here means the results of the curse. Everything is fruitless. Everything is frustrating. And even people who are relatively successful many times, are they happy? No, they're miserable. You know, I was reading, I hope I'm not wrong here, but I think it was an account of Joe Louis, who took in millions with his boxing career. And yet one of his previous opponents, Max Smelling, I think it was, had to pay for his funeral. Is that right? Okay, I'm glad I'm on the right track. Well, that's classic of these people who take in millions, and yet they die paupers. Well, that's the world we live in, see? And so the whole creation has been subjected to vanity, hopelessness. Why? Well, it wasn't their fault. Creation didn't do anything to bring about the curse. You and I didn't do anything to bring about the curse. We're merely the results of it. So it all goes back to whom? Adam. Adam. Boy, I often wonder, how much of that is he going to understand in eternity? How much is Adam going to realize that all the world's sorrows and suffering was preempted by his act of disobedience? Well, whatever. It was made subject to the curse, not willingly, not because of what creation did, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same, that is creation, in what? Hope. So you see, this is why we study Genesis chapter 3, that just as soon as Adam fell and the curse permeated the world, what did God come right back with? What we saw in the last program, that scarlet line of redemption, to show mankind that the day would come when God would finally be superior and would overcome his adversary. All right, so the whole creation now is waiting for this hope that was released as soon as the curse fell. Now verse 21. Because the creation, all of creation itself, shall be what? Delivered. Delivered. Escaping the bondage of corruption. That's the curse again. And it will be delivered from corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. In other words, everything that God has prepared for the believing element of the human race, even creation is going to enjoy the benefits of it. And of course, Isaiah 11 is a perfect example of that, where even the animal kingdom is going to come out from under the curse. And instead of killing each other for their next day's food, they will all live in harmony one with another. And so it will be throughout creation. All the things that Satan disrupted by the curse, God is going to set straight and return it to what it was back in Genesis chapter 1. When he looked on the whole of creation, and what was his conclusion? It was very good. It was perfect, see? And it's going to revert to that one day. Okay, now then, the next verse, verse 22. For we know, you and I as believers, we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain, suffering, and sorrow. All of it together unto now. In other words, there's really nothing that is of the good side in this life under the curse. Even those who seemingly have it so good. And we certainly reckon the fact that they do. But they're still under the turmoil and the suffering and the hopelessness of the curse. So not only they, verse 23, not only all the things of creation, but ourselves. Now again, he's talking to you and I as believers. That you and I as believers who have the first fruit of the Spirit, we have God's saving grace. And we have the first fruit of the Spirit. Even we ourselves, groan within ourselves, waiting for that grand adoption, that change from this earthly environment to the eternal. Now, you know, that has been part and parcel of Paul's teaching from day one. While we're in the New Testament, go forward with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. And if Paul's believers back there in the first century were doing this, then how much more relevant it is for you and I to be doing so today, because we're 1900 and some years closer to all this than they were. All right, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, and he is commending these Greek believers. These are Gentiles. Thessalonica was up in Greece, and he's commending their faith. And how that all the rest of the country of Greece was aware of these Thessalonians and their faith. All right, verse 9. For they themselves, that is their fellow Greek citizens, show of us what manner of entering in we had unto you, and how you, now I love this, how you turned to God from what? From idols. And you've heard me emphasize this before. You want to remember, the whole world, excepting parts of Israel, were steeped in idolatry. They knew nothing of the God of the Bible. And yet the Apostle Paul, with the simple preaching of the gospel, that Christ died for the sins of the world, that he was buried for 3 days and three nights, and arose victoriously over sin and death, simply preaching the gospel, these people came out of that abject idolatry. All right, read on. You turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Now verse 10, and to, what's the next word? Wait. For what? For his Son from heaven. The rapture. Yes, that's what they were looking for. That they too would be suddenly translated from earth to heaven. And if they were waiting then, how much more shouldn't we be waiting today? And so that will be the culmination then of the life under the curse, with all of its heartache and the sin, the wickedness, the degradation, and what have you. But one day it's going to end, it's going to be lifted, and the earth will be delivered from that satanic power. All right, let's come back again to Genesis and move ahead a little further. Genesis chapter 3, once again, the last part of verse 19, and here we have, as part of the covenant, the promise of God that man will see physical death. Now, of course, Paul teaches that there's going to be some of us who will live to hear the trumpet call, but other than that, as Hebrews puts it, it's appointed unto men once to die, and after this, the judgment. That is for the most of mankind. All right, so verse 19 again. As a result of the curse, Genesis 3, in the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, till thou return to the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. Dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. All right, that pretty much consummates then the covenant that we call made with Adam, and set the stage then for the following years of human experience. All right, let's move up to the next one now quickly, to the covenant made with Noah after the flood, and they call it the Noahic covenant, and that will be in Genesis chapter 9. Actually, I guess we can start in the last couple of verses of chapter 8. And this is the next covenant. Now, you got to remember, what has intervened? Now, we've had almost 1,600 years of the human experience under the curse. And the only stipulation was that if they realized or recognized their sin, they could bring an animal sacrifice and God will accept them. But precious few adhered to that. And so for 1,600 years, the human race went down and down and down morally, even though we think they went up, up, up technologically. And so by the time we get to Noah's flood, we have multitudes of people on the earth. I think it's reasonable to assume that there were at least 4 billion or more, and they've gone totally down the tube morally and spiritually. And now then, God is going to move in and judge that generation with their destruction by the flood, and you all know that one. But after the flood, God comes back, and he's going to reestablish yet another covenant with mankind. Genesis chapter 8, and let's just start in verse 20. Noah comes off the ark, and his three sons and their wives and his own wife, eight people. And the first thing he does is builds an altar. He built an altar unto the Lord and took of every clean beast. Remember, he took seven of every kind onto the ark, and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord, verse 21, smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, now here comes the covenant, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, neither will I again smite any more everything living as I have done. Now verse 22, here's the next part of the covenant. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, in other words, the function of our seasons and so forth, will not cease. Now, the next part of the covenant then is going to establish what we call human government in order to maintain law and order. See, they had no government before the flood. There was no established system of religion, as we call it today. So there was absolutely nothing to temper the evil bent of human beings. And that's why they went down so precipitously. There was absolutely nothing to slow it. Now, even pagan religion, when it comes to maintaining a social order, even a pagan religion is better than nothing, because they're at least going to teach them the concept of right and wrong and personal rights. I don't care what the religion is. But before the flood, they didn't have any of that. And so that's why it became so despicable. All right, so now then, God is going to temper that activity with establishing the right of mankind to set up an authority to control the behavior of their fellow human beings. All right, now then we come down to that in verse 3. Now every moving thing that liveth shall be food for you. This is the change in the dietary. Before the flood, they ate nothing but which grew naturally. And I don't think that even the animal kingdom was yet that carnivorous as they became. But mankind especially was never given permission to eat anything that caused the loss of a life. But now they can. See, verse 3, this is the change. Every moving thing that liveth shall be food for you. Even as the green herb, I have given you all things. But here's the stipulation, that if they're going to kill a living creature for food, they had to make sure that all the blood was removed. All right, verse 4, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood. So this is obvious. They are killing living things for food. But the admonition was, never eat it without draining the blood, because the blood was indicative of life. And that, he says, you shall not eat. Then verse 5, here comes the establishment of authority. Surely your blood of your lives I will require. In other words, there's going to be that deterrent to murder by promising that the guilty person would be put to death. All right, verse 5. Surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast I will require it, and the hand of man. Now, in a previous or in a coming program, we're going to be looking at some of the civil laws in Israel. And it's interesting how they covered every aspect of physical existence. In other words, the law stipulated that if I have a bull, and I know he's mean, and I know he's prone to attack, and if I don't confine him and he kills my neighbor, who's guilty? I am. And what's the sentence? Death. Now, that was under the law in Israel. They covered every aspect of the human experience in the civil law, or in what the scripture calls the judgments. Now, you see, this is just the beginning of all that, because Israel's law defined it more in detail. But here we have the responsibility of one human being to protect the life and the property of the other human beings around him. See? All right, so verse 5 again. Surely, your blood of your lives I will require. Now, you see how plain that is? At the hand of every beast. Now, you know, it was interesting. I read a couple years ago where there was a man-killing tiger running loose in India. And after it had killed several kids and so forth, and they would always go back into the jungle, the government actually set up what we would call a posse looking for humans, and they did not stop looking until they had found that, I think it was a leopard, and killed it. Well, why? Because it was guilty of killing human beings, and God has mandated that. It's for the protection of each and every individual. All right, so even of beasts, God will require that if it kills a man, they were to be put to death. At the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Now, that's capital punishment. Now, I know the thing that bothers all of us, and I do myself as much as anybody, is that possibility of putting to death an innocent person, and we shudder at that. But nevertheless, when it's obvious that someone is guilty of murder, then the Scripture is plain. This has never been withdrawn. The Scripture is plain that that guilty person must be put to death, and it's God's only deterrent for holding society together. And then verse 6, I think, exemplifies it. Whosoever sheddeth man's blood, in other words, someone who has purposely killed another human being by man, see? Man's authority under the headship of God, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? Because the human being was created in whose image? God's image. And you see, this is what's, shall I say, intrinsic to Western civilization, which has been influenced probably by Christianity and biblical concepts more than the Eastern world. This is why we have so much a higher esteem for human life than a lot of the nations in, say, Asia, China, and so forth, where life means nothing to them. And it's because they do not have this biblical concept that the human being is made in the image of God. And we are to respect it with that in mind. Now, even the nation of Israel. I don't think there's a race of people on earth that is as careful about the treatment of their dead as are the Jews. My, they won't let a cemetery be uprooted. I know I read in the Jerusalem Post again not too long ago when they were building a highway. And a bulldozer happened to unearth some human bones. They had to stop. They would not let them continue with any more road construction until they determined that there were no more human bones in the area. Well, it just comes all the way back to this concept that the human being is made in the image of God and consequently must be held up with that kind of an esteem. All right, then as you go on into this covenant, there comes the best part of all, of course, and that jumps over to verse 9. Verse 9 in chapter 9, where God again says, I establish my covenant with you. Now remember, God's covenants are begun in God, they end with God. The human race has no room to barter or negotiate. God lays it down, and that settles it. All right, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, whether it's fowl or cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. Verse 11, I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the what? The waters of a flood. Never again will God destroy the earth with water. And now verse 12. And this is the token of the covenant, which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. And this is still in vogue. I do set my bow, the rainbow, in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And as long as we see the rainbow, then that's God's promise that he will never again destroy the whole earth with water. Now, he will destroy it one day with fire, but he will never again send a flood upon the earth. And we have this constant reminder that every time you see the rainbow. Now, you see, the reason this was such a unique promise is because before the flood, it never rained on the earth. Consequently, there were no clouds to cause a rainbow, and it was watered from beneath. But after the flood, the weather patterns come in, and consequently, you have rain, you have dark clouds, and we have the rainbow. And it becomes then the covenant relationship between God and the planet Earth and everything that's in it.
Thank you for watching Through the Bible with Les Feldick. Through the Bible is a partner-supported ministry. If this program has been a help to your study of the Scriptures and you'd like to see others enjoy the teaching, your support would be greatly appreciated. Write to us at Les Feldick Ministries, 30706 West Lona Valley Road, Kenta, Oklahoma, 74552. Or call 1-800-369-7856. Remember, all programs are available in printed form, audio cassette, and videotape. Be sure to tune in next time to Through the Bible with Les Feldick.